Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Economics Report and American Mosaic, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. On June 6, 1944, Allied forces began landing along the coast of Normandy in France. The event is known as D-Day. It was the beginning of a campaign by the United States and its allies to end the German occupation of Europe. D-Day was a turning point in World War II. World leaders are in Normandy on Friday to honor the men who carried out the greatest invasion by sea in history. And former soldiers are remembering the importance of D-Day. We will hear from them later in the show. We begin today by going back in time more than 70 years to the war in Europe. Germany and its allies had won the early battles of World War II. By the end of 1943, the German military had suffered defeats and was weakened, but it was still powerful enough to control France, Belgium, and much of the rest of Western Europe. The time had come for the United States and its allies to liberate the continent. The Supreme Allied Commander, American General Dwight Eisenhower, used radio to speak to the troops preparing to land on Normandy.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world.
The German leader, Adolf Hitler, had known an invasion was coming, but he did not know where the Allied force would strike. Most Germans expected the Allies would attack at Calais in northern France, but they were wrong. General Eisenhower planned to attack Normandy across the English Channel. Eisenhower had 150,000 men and 12,000 airplanes for the attack. But most importantly, he had surprise on his side. Even after the invasion began, General Erwin Rommel and other German military leaders could not believe that the Allies had really attacked at Normandy. But attack they did. On the night of June 5th, tens of thousands of Allied soldiers parachuted behind German lines. Then Allied planes began dropping bombs on German defenses. And in the morning, thousands of ships approached the coastline, carrying men and supplies. The battle quickly became fierce and bloody. American, British, and other Allied forces moved on five beaches from their landing craft. The Germans had strong defenses. They were better protected than the Allied troops on the open beaches. But the Allies had more troops. On all but one of those areas, German resistance was lighter than expected. At Omaha Beach, two American divisions were slowed by the rising tide and heavy German gunfire. It was the fiercest and bloodiest battle of D-Day. Slowly, the Allied soldiers moved forward on one part of the Normandy coast, then another. The Allies continued to build up their forces in France. Within 1 week, they had brought nearly 90,000 vehicles and 600,000 men into France, and they pushed forward. A total of 3,000 American soldiers died on Omaha Beach alone 70 years ago. On the first day of the invasion, Almost 10,000 Allied troops were killed or wounded. The Battle of Normandy continued through August as Allied troops fought the Germans through France. In less than 4 months, General Eisenhower and the Allied forces had regained almost all of France. More than 400,000 Allied and German troops were wounded, killed, or missing in action. The D-Day anniversary brings back memories for the men who fought in World War II, but it is also meaningful for other military veterans. Anna Mateo joins us.
Hundreds of people visit the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. every day. Many of them go there to honor family members or friends who died during the war. Among the visitors one recent day was 89-year-old Sewin Johnson. He was only 19 when he lost his arm fighting in France.
We were fighting in the village of Oberhofen, which was near about 20 miles west of Strasbourg, and we'd been in that village three times trying to take the town. We'd gotten the Germans all boxed up at the end of the village, and Jerry heard the tank coming up the street. He sent the artillery in and hit the tank, and that's when I got hit too at the same time.
Frederick Douglass Williams is now 92. He flew combat planes in Europe as part of the all-black Tuskegee Airmen group. He says the hardest part of going to war was thinking about the loved ones waiting for his safe return.
I like what Winston Churchill said. They also serve who sit and wait. Mothers, sweethearts. Hey, my poor mother, she went crazy. We knew, we expected death, all right? But not them. Where's my son?
Christopher Jung is a research fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the U.S. National Defense University. He wrote a book on the military planning for D-Day.
It is one of the most important military operations ever conducted, probably the largest amphibious assault ever undertaken, that it took a great deal of military thinking, ingenuity, perseverance. Is the first step in which the Allies were able to get back onto the continent. The Germans had erected a gigantic fortress, Fortress Europa, to prevent the Allies from returning.
Brigadier General Bruno Catacoli is the top defense official at the French Embassy in Washington. His father fought in the war.
What my dad really explained me so many times is the importance of being ready to defend what is not a given, which is freedom, democracy, etc.
General Catacoli has a picture in his office to help him remember the sacrifices made by so many during World War II. I'm Anna Mateo.
You can read and listen to this report on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. This site also has video reports about D-Day. Special thanks to Miriama Diallo and Steve Ember for their help in producing this program. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for listening.
The Economics Report is next, followed by American Mosaic. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. On May 30th, a court in Cambodia found guilty 23 clothing workers and union members. They were arrested during violent protests in January, in which at least 4 workers were killed. However, the court immediately suspended the sentences. International companies had watched the case closely. Some had threatened to reconsider using Cambodian clothing factories. Rights groups have criticized the trial. They say it is an attempt to use the courts to influence workers in the economically important clothing industry. The 23 were arrested over a 2-day period during wage protests in January. Officials acted with live ammunition. There has been no investigation into the killings of the 4 workers. The defendants were charged with a number of offenses, including incitement and property damage. Legal experts said the trial did not meet international guidelines. They said the judge barred defendants from speaking or questioning witnesses. The court sentenced the defendants to 1 to 4.5 years. However, it then ruled to suspend the sentences to time already served. That meant the defendants would be freed. Dave Welsh is the country representative for the U.S.-based labor group Solidarity Center. He says the defendants and their families were pleased with the decision.
The main thing is it's just an enormous amount of relief, first of all, with them, with their families, and with the trade union and human rights community in general. They're going to be free today.
The clothing or garment manufacturing industry is an important part of Cambodia's economy, providing about $5.5 billion in exports last year. Factories produce clothing mainly for the European Union and the United States. However, unrest about pay has resulted in deadly protests. The monthly minimum wage currently stands at $100. The garment workers want that raised to $160. There is also a disputed law related to trade unions that the government wants to pass by the end of the year. A delegation of international clothing companies recently spoke to top government officials. Representatives from H&M, Puma, and The Gap said they would find other sources for their products unless worker conditions improved. The garment industry in Cambodia employs about 600,000 workers. The brands offered to pay more to factories that employ workers, but they say the Cambodian government must also act by not using violence or the courts against protesters. And that's the Economics Report in VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to American Mosaic from VOA Learning English. I'm June Sims. Today on the show, we hear new music from Coldplay, and Washington, D.C. now has a Ferris wheel. We will tell you all about it. But first, a report on a young Chinese immigrant
who is expert in a very old art from her homeland. The Chinese art of paper cutting has a long history. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization has recognized the art, called Jianzhi, on its intangible cultural heritage list. But Jianzhi is at risk of disappearing. Katie Weaver tells us about a Chinese immigrant to the United States who hopes to bring the art back to life.
Voyo Wu loves paper cutting.
It's called a dragon boat racing.
And she works hard to celebrate the ancient art form.
The earliest paper cutting was found in China 1,500 years ago.
On a recent Saturday, Ms. Wu held a paper cutting show at a shopping center near Washington. She demonstrated the art for hours to crowds at the center.
I really like it. I get so much fun and peace doing it. So I'm just hoping that more people will learn about this art that's kind of dying and enjoy it like I do.
Voyo Wu began to study the art of Jianzhi as a 14-year-old in her hometown in southeastern China. She says all the students at school had to learn the art, but she says she discovered a special love for it. So her teacher gave her extra training after class.
It was actually a mandatory art class for everybody, but I just found a special passion for it. So my teacher, she was willing to give me extra tutoring after class to train me in paper cutting.
Later, she won second prize in a national painting and calligraphy competition.
Paper is the easiest material that you can find. You can just turn it into a beautiful, intricate art. I think it's like magic to me.
Ms. Wu came to the U.S. after she finished college in 2008. Soon after, she became involved in an event to support and expand understanding of Chinese paper cutting. She has been invited to demonstrate the art at a wide collection of events. She also has shown her skill at famed museums like the Smithsonian Institution's Freer and Sackler Art Galleries in Washington.
I saw so many people coming to me and asking me. They were amazed. I think that it's important to promote the art form to American people or anyone who's interested. And then maybe it will lead to another thriving of this art form back in China.
Ms. Wu says paper cutting represents Chinese cultural values, history, and stories of people's lives. She uses the art as a tool to present Chinese culture to people who know little about it.
People, when they see it, they ask, what's the story behind this? And that's when the opportunity knocks, when you can actually explain to them, for example, what is the Chinese Lantern Festival?
Ms. Wu placed examples of her art around her as she demonstrated paper cutting at the shopping center. Some shoppers, like Anne Russ, took part in a workshop. Ms. Russ was struck by the finely detailed nature of the work. She said it put her at ease.
So I would like to know about Chinese art specifically. It's very delicate, and I like the focus that it requires. It just takes me out of everything when you have to concentrate on something very closely. It's almost relaxing to put that much effort into it.
Voyo Wu says Chinese art is for all people.
It's amazing how Chinese art can resonate, can echo with people from other cultural backgrounds.
I'm Katie Weaver.
Ferris wheels are very tall, rounded structures that move in circular motion from top to bottom. They are commonly found at carnivals and amusement parks. People ride them for fun, although they don't go really fast like a roller coaster. Ferris wheels also provide riders with a great look at their surroundings. A new Ferris wheel, known as the Capitol Wheel, is doing just that in the Washington area. The structure stands 55 meters above the Potomac River. It is one of the few observation Ferris wheels in the world that is right on the water. LaShonda Johnson lives in the area. She says she got a new look at the city she knows well.
So the Capitol and all the historical museums and traffic, it was just peaceful.
The National Harbor is home to the Ferris wheel. The harbor is just outside Washington in Oxon Hill, Maryland. It is a new public center with shops, restaurants, and hotels, and now a Ferris wheel. The wheel has 42 cars, or gondolas, with heating and cooling systems. It can hold 336 riders. Kent Digby is operations director for the National Harbor. He says the Ferris wheel is very different from an amusement park ride. The idea is for people to enjoy some calming moments.
Well, it's very smooth, so you really, if you weren't paying too much attention, you wouldn't really notice that you're moving. And that's all part of trying to make people comfortable and make sure that they understand that they're very safe.
The cost is $15 per person for a 15-minute ride. Mark Poliquin, who came from the state of Connecticut with his family, says the ride was worth it.
Top of the line, air-conditioned cabs, they got music playing.
The $15 million machine was built in the United States. Some of the parts are from Germany, and the gondolas came from Switzerland. It is similar to the London Eye Ferris wheel in Britain's capital. The London Eye was the world's tallest Ferris wheel until 2006. Now, that honor belongs to the high roller Ferris wheel that recently opened in Las Vegas, Nevada. It stands 167 meters in the air. The next tallest is the Singapore Flyer in Singapore, followed by the Star of Nanchang in China. Bulgarian Yavor Todorov says his children wanted to go on a ride, but he admits he had a good time as well.
It's exciting. You can see the whole Washington, D.C.
Each gondola seats 8 people, except for one special VIP car, which holds 4. There, for $50 per person, you can bring a bottle of wine.
I call it our little Ferrari. It's all red and black leather, and it's pretty slick with wine coolers and its own pop-up TV. And I'm sure more than one person will get engaged on a ride.
Kent Digby says the light show on the Ferris wheel is another treat. He says the lights can be made to go on and off in thousands of different orders.
1,600,000 lights, and they can light up in any different color of the rainbow.
The Capitol Wheel is open every day. Up to 800,000 people are expected to take the ride the first year. Recently, we got a letter from China. 26-year-old Judge Young asked if we could talk about and play some music from Coldplay on American Mosaic. Anna Mateo is here to meet that request.
The British band Coldplay hit the airwaves around the turn of the millennium. Their first album, Parachutes, was released in 2000. The group had a major hit with the song Yellow.
Look at the stars, look how they shine for you.
singer Chris Martin leads Coldplay. Johnny Buckland is lead guitarist. Guy Berryman plays bass. And Will Champion is the band's drummer. Chris Martin recently said that Coldplay is successful because its members work well together. He said he does not know where the song ideas come from. But he says, once they do come, the band builds on the ideas, together, layer by layer. Martin likened it to building a car. He also said the fact that the band always shared all the money and all the credit has helped avoid disputes. Coldplay released its sixth studio album, Ghost Stories, last month. Critic Karen Gantz of Rolling Stone magazine suggested the ghost of the album is Chris Martin's wife, actress Gwyneth Paltrow. In March, the two announced that they were ending their marriage. The first song is called Always in My Head. But though I try, my heart stays still, never moves, just won't be led. And so my mouth waters to be fed, and you're always in my head, you're always in my head. Critic Josh Terry of Consequence of Sound is not as excited by Ghost Stories, but he does praise a few songs, including Another's Arms.
Late night watching TV, used to be here beside me, used to be your arms around me, your body on my body. When the world means nothing to
Coldplay is currently touring around the world. They performed in Paris at the end of May. In the next few weeks, they will appear in Tokyo, Sydney, and London. We leave you with A Sky Full of Stars from the new Coldplay album, Ghost Stories.
'Cause you're a sky, 'cause you're a sky full of stars. I'm gonna give you my heart, 'cause you're a sky, 'cause you're a sky full of stars, 'cause you light up the path.
I'm June Sims. Our program was written and produced by Katie Weaver. Join us again next week for American Mosaic from VOA Learning English.